Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I am your host, Dwayne Mancini. As always, if you have any suggestions for future guests or want to get a hold of the podcast, please email us at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. My guest today is Jose Borquez. Jose is the president of Boldtype, which is a company that specializes in developing cutting-edge connected wireless medical devices. They are experts in hardware and software development and can help take companies from FDA CE clearance through volume production. In this episode of the podcast, Jose and I discuss everything that has to do with connected wireless medical devices. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Jose Borquez.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Jose, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Absolutely. So I mentioned you're the president of Boldtype. I think maybe let's give the listeners and the audience just an introduction to what Boldtype is and how you came about finding the company.
Sure. Yeah, so we're a product development firm that specializes in connected wireless medical devices. So, you know, if you've got a medical device and it's got some sort of wireless connectivity, for example, to like a cell phone or to some other type of device, and then that data ultimately ends up in the cloud, then that's the kind of products that we specialize in.
Okay, great. And you know, your background. So you're the president and founder, I presume. What's your background? How did you decide, hey, I'm going to venture off on my own? You know, maybe kind of fill the listeners in on that.
Yeah. So my background is I've got a PhD in electrical engineering. I did that at MIT. And prior to going for my PhD, I worked for a couple of years in industry doing chips. So I was doing primarily RF, wireless communication chips or ASICs, if you will. So from that, and even prior to that, so that was after my master's. After my bachelor's, I did a four-month stint at GE Healthcare. It was kind of like a co-op thing. And that was my first introduction to medical devices. But then I went and worked in hardware development for integrated circuits. And then I went to MIT, and I kind of combined the two of those things. And I did all my research there in ultra-low power systems and circuits for medical devices. And during my time there, having worked at a venture-backed startup prior to going to MIT, one of my mentors from there really encouraged me to look at entrepreneurship. And so I did that. So I did my minor in business. And towards the end of my PhD, I started a medical devices company with a neurology professor at Harvard. And I ran that for about 7 years. And so we developed technology for non-invasive diagnostics of patients with neuromuscular disorders. And so that's my first exposure really to the regulated world and design controls and quality management systems and then development. And we ended up launching both medical and consumer products. So I also became very interested in how do you develop products for consumers. And so the thing that happened about 3.5 years ago is, I've been leading that company for 7 years. I felt like I needed a change. And I kind of looked at the mirror and said, what do you really enjoy doing? And for me, it's product development, right? So when you're an OEM or you're manufacturing, you're developing the product as phase one, and then you've got to go, market and sell and distribution and reimbursement and like all this kind of stuff that I wasn't as passionate about. What I really loved was product development. And I said, what if I start a company where all I do is product development? And that's where Boldtype came about. And I was very fortunate. I found two great co-founders. One of them is the former chief software architect for Motorola's two-way radio division. So he was a top software engineer in a group of about 2,000. And then my other co-founder, somebody I've known for 20 years, he's a Harvard business school graduate and has been doing leadership for software development teams for the last 10 years or so. And so together, we lead a team of about 30 engineers now that specialize in connected wireless medical devices.
Great. So thanks for the background. That's super helpful. Now, do you take companies through
like FDA clearance now, and then kind of, you know, that's as far as you take it, or are you just working on the design and making sure that's done in a regulated environment? Because, you know, obviously, you knowing that that you've been through the process, you understand how important it is to design a product, but design it, you know, within the regulations, or you can cause yourself a headache. So is that kind of, will you help all the way through FDA submission and then kind of step off, or where does that engagement end?
Yeah, I mean, it'll largely depend on the client and their, what their team looks like and their areas of expertise. We've got clients, for example, where we are their entire product development team. They don't have any engineers in their own team, or maybe one or two. And so for those types of clients, we do everything from, you know, even early user research. We'll either lead that or support them in that effort through prototyping, through product development, through helping them select the right contract manufacturer if they don't already have one, helping to transfer everything to the contract manufacturer, and then even post-launch, supporting with sustainment engineering, and, you know, if there's engineering change orders that are required, you know, if there's any kind of issues or improvements that are desired, helping them go through the proper process of engineering change orders and making sure that we perform the appropriate type of testing. We also support their submission of 510K. Usually most of our clients want to file it themselves and they want to own the K number. But we've got a full-time quality assurance and regulatory affairs director who's got, you know, more than 25 successful 510Ks under her belt. So she's able to put together most of the package for the 510K and then work together with our client's regulatory department to, you know, put their finishing touches on it, submit it, and we'll function as a resource there on that front.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a couple things there, because you touched on two. They're two totally different. So I'll write the one down and we'll come back to it. But we'll go with the most recent one, the regulatory environment, you having that internal, you know, that's a big deal. Software at by itself, but also integrated with an actual hard medical device, is relatively new. So, you know, the importance of having that in-house seems pretty valuable, just dealing with the FDA. You know, I think sometimes people think that it's new, but the FDA will have it under control. And it's like, well, it's the FDA's first time reviewing a product like this. So maybe talk, can you speak to some of those challenges that a client might face, or do you really just leave that up to her? You know, either way, it's okay if that's the case. I just figured I'd ask, because I know that software, whether it's a medical device or not, can be difficult. And, you know, cybersecurity, like what are the kind of things the FDA is looking for there, even if it's high level?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's a great point that people tend to underestimate the increased burdens that come when developing software for medical devices. Mm-hmm. And it's quite varied. So, you know, for starters, there's very good guidance documents that FDA recognizes, such as IEC 62304. So it's about a 90-page document that describes the process that FDA would expect you to follow for software development that goes into a medical device. And so as with most things FDA related, it has to do with risk, right? So one of the first things you would do is look at what's the risk profile of this product. You know, if the software fails, and you effectively have to assume it will for that type of risk analysis. If it fails, is the patient going to get hurt? You know, and if they're going to get hurt, is it a minor injury or is it a major injury? And that decision tree takes you to, is it class A, is it class B, or is it class C? And as you might imagine, depending on which classification it falls under, there's added burdens. So if it's class B or class C, it's going to be higher burdens than class A. So things like, you know, they're going to expect you to have a software development plan and a software configuration management plan, and, you know, expect you to have things like software architectures, software design descriptions, you know, various forms of ensuring that your code is going to be of high quality. You know, if you're doing class B or class C software development, you're going to have to have unit testing and, you know, in addition to integration testing and final testing. So there's a lot of steps and documentation that you have to ensure that you have in place when you're doing software for medical devices. The other piece of it that you also mentioned is cybersecurity. And that one, of course, is particularly important for the types of products we do, because they're both wireless and cloud connected. And those serve as what they call attack vectors, right? So whenever you've got product that has software in particular, it creates opportunities for a hacker or, you know, some sort of bad actor to either extract information from that or even change the functionality, right? So the kind of the worst case scenario one might envision is, you know, somebody with a pacemaker. What if I can hack your pacemaker and force it to kill you, right? So you have to be able to think about these scenarios and, depending on the risk level, put additional controls in place. It's not very different than all other types of risk controls that FDA would have you look at, right? So it's similar type of process, but you wanna have people on your team who understand cybersecurity, because they'll be able to better understand what are the possible attack vectors and what are the appropriate controls for the specific software that you're developing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. The other one I had written down, I do want to come back to cybersecurity, because I find it fascinating, and the risk reward balance and that kind of thing. But you mentioned contract manufacturing. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of designing a product that is actually manufacturable? Because I see this happen with startups that I work with. Is they build a prototype, they come to me, they want to talk about some preclinical studies, and they think this is going to be their, you know, their design freeze phase after their preclinical study. And then all of a sudden we start moving down the path of some other things, but they go talk to a contract manufacturer and they say, this isn't, you know, I can't manufacture this. It needs to be easier. This is going to be way too expensive. So, you know, maybe talk a little bit about that and how you know, what your process is, how you coach people through that, because I've seen a lot of companies get tripped up there, and it's not necessarily something, it's not in my sweet spot. So I don't understand it. I just know, oh, they got screwed up there, you know, but maybe talk a little bit about that and how do you mitigate that risk?
Yeah, no, it's a classic kind of challenge, especially that startups face. You know, you see it in more established companies as well, but I see it more commonly with startups. In particular, oftentimes the founding team is either not super technical, or on the contrary, they're technical but haven't been through a lot of new product introduction phases. And so, you know, one thing that I've observed is that people think when they have a prototype, they're like 90% done, and it's the opposite. They're like maybe 10% done when they've got a functional prototype. You're just barely getting started in the process if you're doing medical device product development. And, you know, it's a balancing act, because on the one hand, there are certain important things that you're trying to learn early that you don't necessarily want to slow down by unnecessary process or doing things that are looking too far ahead, right? If you're still experimenting with form factor, you don't want to take each of those CAD files and pass them through a full design for manufacturability process, because maybe you're looking at three different form factors and you're only going to move forward with one. So it might be too early to start thinking about that. On the other hand, you want to at least have a minimal sense of, you know, is this going to be manufacturable? Because if you do test three form factors and the one that wins, like you said, then you go and you realize you can't even manufacture it in volume, well, then you just wasted your time. So it's a balancing act. You wanna have enough, what they call DFX analysis up front. So design for, and then the X is manufacturability, testability, assembly, right? The various things that you're gonna need to do in volume production. You're gonna want somebody experienced in your team who can look at it and go, you know, maybe this still isn't perfect for volume production. Maybe the draft angles need to be a little bit different, or we might want to use snaps instead of screws, but I see a clear path towards making this design manufacturable with some straightforward changes. You know, that's not a detailed time, you know, expensive in terms of time and money effort, but at least it puts you on the right track. Now, once you've gotten through that, what you were talking about, that clinical data that maybe tells you, yes, this is going to work, you know, it has the features that are required. Now you go into a more detailed process of design for manufacturability, test, and assembly. And I always recommend that people kind of get their contract manufacturer engaged early in that process. Because, you know, in our case, for example, we've got engineers who are very experienced in design for manufacturability and test and assembly, but the specific contract manufacturer you're going to work with is likely to have their own requirements. And they also have very experienced engineers that all they do is manufacturing. So they're going to give you insight and input that's going to be valuable. So to the extent possible, where you can, engage your contract manufacturer early and have them involved in some of that DFX analysis.
Okay, that's helpful. You know, some of the other capabilities we haven't really touched on yet from Bold Type, we kind of covered it at a high level, but maybe we can talk a little bit about it as we drill down into here. So you support companies with, we talked about this on the pre-call, right? Electronics, so actual hardware. We talked about firmware and we talked about software. Can you kind of delineate the three? I know I asked you before, so I didn't sound like I was completely ignorant to this, but I think if I have the question, maybe someone else does. So maybe talk about the difference between the three, you know, sure, as you support them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, in any medical device, especially if it's the type that we develop, which is going to be cloud connected, you're going to have, it almost always has hardware, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason I say almost always, because now there's this new category of software as a medical device. And so you've actually got therapeutics that are purely software, but the vast majority of medical devices have a physical component to it. And that's the hardware. So the two main components of hardware tend to be some sort of mechanical housing, so the thing that holds the electronics, and then electronics, so a printed circuit board, for example, inside. So that's the hardware piece of it, and you know, we can help with that. And you know, on the mechanical side, usually that starts with usability analysis to understand how the product's gonna be used, then doing some industrial design. So what is it gonna look like and feel like and function like? And then the mechanical engineering, and then the electronics. And so now we start into the next category, which is firmware. And firmware is the software that goes into the device. So the device is gonna have usually a microprocessor, which is like a tiny computer. And the software that's in those microprocessors is generally referred to either as firmware or as embedded software. So that's the second type of you know, or category, if you will. And then the third one is what we talk about as software, it tends to be applications. So that can be mobile applications. You know, maybe you have a device that connects to a phone. So iOS, Android applications, it can be a web application. And then on the cloud, you've also got software there. So you're going to have some sort of server applications, you're going to have databases. And then oftentimes you've even got additional software on the other side of that, which is grabbing data from the cloud or adding it. So for example, you might have a dashboard that a clinician can log into and see data for some of their patients. Or you might have a web application that you know, the company itself, the OEM, can log into and understand the health of the fleet of devices that they've sent out. Or you can even, like, one of the big values of having cloud connectivity is you might find that you can add a feature to the device that's going to improve it for devices that are already in the field. And you can do that through what's called over-the-air software updates. So what that means is the OEM can put a piece of software into the cloud. That software gets sent out to all of the devices on the field. And then all of a sudden that device that the patient might have at home or a clinician has in their office gets better, right? It has a new feature, or they're able to correct a bug that they discovered without having to do a recall. So that would also be part of what's developed for software.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, can you talk a little bit too? Are you working with implants that are connected to the cloud? Have you worked on any of these? I mean, you don't have to be specific, but in broad terms, is this something you guys have worked on at Bold Type?
So we haven't done implants that are implanted through surgery. Mm-hmm. I'd say probably the closest we've come to that is we have worked on an intravaginal device where the device sits inside the vagina for a period of up to 30 days.
Okay. And so
it's inside the body, the patient has it with them, but you don't have to go through surgery for that.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I'm curious because, you know, so I watched over the course of the last like three nights, and it's not that long. I was just tired and falling asleep, but I watched The Social Dilemma. It's a new documentary on Netflix. It's about social media and how it's like ruining our society. but at the end they brought up computing power and they showed a graph of the acceleration in computing power and the size of the chips in the last like 30 years. And it's the most progress we've made in that short a time and in anything else, right? Like just in comparison. So I was curious, you know, to see, like, did you think that the next wave of implants are going to be connected to the cloud? I'm sure it has to do with, it sounds like computing power, battery life, it's all going to be there. You know, it's just going to be the cybersecurity on the cloud and how worried people are about that and how we could protect that. But I didn't know if you had an opinion on that or, you know, what you kind of thought about that. Cause that's where my mind went when I saw that was these chips. I mean, chips are small. You could put them in these implants and then implants can do much more or send data more. You know, you could start putting sensors in these implants and reading blood levels of, you know, like levels of different things in your blood. It just seemed like that's where my head went when I saw that stat. I was curious if you had any thoughts on where you saw that industry going. Is it going to take off? You know, what have you seen?
Yeah, I think, you know, the rate of acceleration in technology and electronics and information science, you know, was kind of predicted in the, I think it was 60s or 70s. And became known as Moore's Law, where there was an observation that technology was essentially doubling in its power every 18 months, which is, you know, it's an exponential increase, which is incredible, right? I mean,
yeah.
When I could probably think back to when we were in high school and maybe had a computer and, you know, our cell phone is now 1,000 times more powerful than that computer, which, you know, was maybe 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So, The rate of acceleration is incredible. And if you then project it out into the future, you know, the sky is the limit in terms of what's possible. But I think technology, it's very hard to rein back, right? And the observation I would have on where we are as a society is that although we worry about certain things, we tend to always, the benefit always kind of tends to surpass the worry, right? Mm-hmm. So we all say we worry about privacy, but, you know, we sell it pretty cheaply the benefits of things as, you know, mundane as entertainment, right? So it's like, well, geez, I don't want you to have my data, but if it allows me to share information about myself on social media, then I will. It's like, wow, that wasn't that hard. So when it comes to our health, you know, I think if people are given the option of having a device that's going to help them, you know, overcome a disease or live with it longer, right, improves their quality of life, but it introduces a small risk around cybersecurity or around privacy. I think the observation right now is that people are willing to make that trade-off. And what it means for us on the development side is that we bear the responsibility of minimizing that risk as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where FDA is. I think that's where a lot of responsible product development firms or OEMs are.
You know,
you're trading one thing off for another. The cost benefit probably favors the incorporation of advanced technologies. And, you know, absolutely. I think, you know, with a lot of data is already going to the cloud from these medical devices. And I don't think we've even started to scratch the surface of the impact that's going to have, not just on the industry, but in society. Mm-hmm. I happen to think that there's a lot of diseases that we don't understand enough because it's so expensive to perform a clinical trial, for example. So a clinical trial with 200-300 people can cost, you know, millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars.
Yep.
That's just with 200-300 people. Now, when you release a product that has a reach of 200,000-300,000 people, and if all of that data can go to the cloud and you can perform meta-analysis on that, you know, the power of that is incredible. And I think we're going to come to understand diseases much better and be able to develop therapies that are more targeted.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point. You think about wearables, right? So like I have, the Whoop band, you know, are they tracking, where I'm going? I'm sure of it. Right. I mean, when I run, it tells me my map, but it's things like that I'm willing to, I'm okay with this. I'm okay with them knowing that because, you know, they're telling me my heart rate variability, my heart rate, the cardiovascular strain, you know, my central nervous strain. Like they're able to tell me all these things. How does getting 8 hours sleep versus 7 hours of sleep affect my recovery? It's things that I never had access to, but are important to me as like a, like, you know, I enjoy exercising. So these are important to me. And, you know, it's things that, that can help. I mean, there was a study that they had, and I don't know it. I don't know all the details for sure, but it had something to do with respiratory rate. And they saw that when people were reportedly getting sick, not just from COVID, but any other kind of upper respiratory issue, you know, a cold or anything like that, their respiratory rate when they were sleeping was going up and it was out of range. And they were able to sit there and, you know, and kind of predict that a little bit. So things like that, that, you know, they have access to a lot of my data, but I have access to a lot of it. So it's neat for me, you know? But that's where I kind of see a lot of that going is the wearable markets, like the next big thing to take off. And it's getting more advanced each time, right? Didn't Apple Watch just come out with, like an EKG or something like this on their Apple Watch?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the big convergence that's happening, right? Between the medical world and the consumer world. And essentially it's like a consumerization of medical technology. And that trend is only going to accelerate. But you know, like what you mentioned earlier about the band that you've got, I kind of laugh sometimes when people talk about, you know, the conspiracies of being implanted with chips and they're going to know where you are all the time. And yet every one of us carries a cell phone around with us. That, so we already, they, wherever they are, already know where you are all the time. Right. The thing has a microphone, it's got cameras, it's, you know, we're already living in that world.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got the opportunity to take some benefits on your health with some of those devices, it's, people are probably going to choose to do so.
Yeah. Yep. So do you live in the world of wearables mostly, or where is Bold Type's, you know, sweet spot? I mean, obviously it's software and hardware and joining those two. But is there a sweet spot of a type of a device you like to work on, or do you guys go all therapeutic areas?
No, I would say that the majority of the products that we work on tend to be on the smaller side.
Okay.
You know, if something's going to be wireless, it's probably going to be portable. That's where a lot of the value comes. They tend to be home use devices. Not always. We've got some devices that are used at a clinical facility, but the value prop is usually higher for applications where you want the device to go home with the patient, because then it's that much more important for the data to come to the cloud so a clinician can have access to it, or the patient can access it later. That sort of thing. So smaller home use, wearable, you know, yes, it falls into the category, but not only, you know, there's other devices that we work on that are used, you know, on a daily basis, but they're not necessarily worn on the body. So that, yeah, it's roughly the space we play in.
Okay. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit before I come back at the end to Bold Type and, you know, how do people get a hold of you and that sort of thing. So obviously you work with, I'm guessing, is your clientele startups and large companies, everything in between, or do you? Okay. But you ran a startup before, and you work with startups. So, you know, and my audience isn't focused on just startup companies in the medical device space, but I have a feeling that a lot of people who listen to this are probably in that realm. So advice for startup companies, you know, building products in the med tech industry. Do you have any tips of trade or what you found successful when you were doing it and still are doing it?
Yeah. So I think I'll say this, and it's, I know it's so self-serving, but if you're doing a product that's wireless and connected, it's a fairly complex product to develop, and it requires a broad mix of expertise. And so you're probably best served by having someone else do it. Mm-hmm. And the reason, I think sometimes startups in particular are trying to conserve capital, and so they try to do the product development themselves. And we've had clients in both, you know, let me take one step back. What I've observed about startups is that they tend to have a leadership team that is very business focused, or they tend to have a leadership team that is very technical in their, you know, their background. For the teams that are technical in the background, one of the challenges they face, you know, paradoxically, is that they think it's best for them to develop the technology themselves. And oftentimes it ends up being a big distraction, because successfully marketing and launching a medical device requires a very broad skill set as well. So if you kind of go, okay, we need a broad skill set in general to launch a successful medical device company, and then within that, you've got product development, and that requires a very broad skill set, you're now forcing yourself to have a very large team to launch your first product. And that can have, you know, some big challenges. But, you know, as an example, some of the products we develop require, you know, easily 15 different specialties. That doesn't mean that you've got to carry a team of 15 full-time employees, right? You might have some specialties that are only involved for, you know, 2 months at 30% of their rate. But if you're trying to build everything internally, you're hiring each of those positions, you're going to end up with a large team where you don't need that. So as an example, you might need an industrial designer early in a project to make sure that you've got something really beautiful and functional, but you don't need that person the whole time. Mm-hmm. You know, similarly, when you're doing a mobile application, you want a really good user experience researcher, you want a really good user experience designer, and you want a really good visual designer. Those are actually three different specialties. And sometimes people will hire one person to do all three, even though, you know, that person's probably only good at one and okay mm-hmm. two. When you're outsourcing that and you've got a team that just has, you know, an A player at each of those positions, they're going to be able to come in for the phase of the project when you need them. And then when they walk, you know, and walk away, so you're not carrying that financial burden when you no longer need them. The other piece is that because it's in the regulated industry, there's a lot of overhead associated with just the quality management system and design controls. And if you're building that up, if you're building up your QMS while building the team, while building the product, you introduce a lot of variables and a lot of risk from a business point of view. So it's quite challenging to do that. Whereas if you work with a team that's been, you know, has a mature QMS in place, the team is already trained on it, the team is already there, they know how to operate under it, they're going to be much more efficient. So I think companies erroneously think they're going to save money by doing certain things in-house. And in the end, they actually spend a lot more and they introduce a lot of risk. So that's, you know, one piece of advice.
Yeah. So I think that you think of, so obviously I have nothing to do with design, engineering, anything like this. All of my expertise lies on the regulatory reimbursement, clinical side of things. But the same thing you just discussed is how I talk to clients about that portion of it. So I think we share the same vision on how you should go about this. And your what you said about marketing and launching a product, that is 100% where startup companies need to focus their time, their full-time employees, is having that plan and understanding that you're exactly right. These regulatory folks, the reimbursement folks, the clinical folks, they're going to come in and out. They don't need to be full-time employees. It's the same thing on the engineering side. How can you get the best talent with the least amount of cost, you know, to burn through your capital burn rate, right? Because that's the other thing I try to get people to understand is however long you think it's going to take you to your exit plan, you might as well just go ahead and double it because you're probably off. And you know, the longer it takes, the more capital you have to raise, the more people who is full-time, the more people you have to pay, and the less of your company you're going to own whenever you do hit your exit plan or commercialize this thing. And it's a killer to watch some of these startup companies go through that and not listen. And then they you know, they get to commercial launch and they can't access a regional market. And then the private equity team does what they're supposed to do, come in and pick them up for, you know, pennies on the dollar. And that's it. They, you know, they wasted 6 or 7 years. They didn't get what they should have got for the work they put in. And then that technology either goes sits on a shelf or becomes successful at whoever just bought it, you know? So it's tough to watch that, but you're 100% right. If you're a startup company and I need to build this product and I come to you and you say, yeah, I have experts in all those areas. And you know what? The best part is you could turn them on when you need them and turn them off when you don't. And it's like, oh, that's a no-brainer. But people still don't do it. People, you know, go the other route, and sometimes it's just, it's brutal to watch that. So I'm glad you brought that up, because that's how I envision my part of what I do for companies. So it's good to, you know, see the counterpart on the other half of it, which is the engineering. So it's cool.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you made a good point within that, which is that medical device product development and commercialization has some stop and go elements to it, right? Mm-hmm. Once you submit for a 510K, you know, maybe it gets cleared. We've had products that cleared in 2 months, but maybe it takes 3, maybe it takes 6, maybe it takes 12, right? And yep. If you've already brought on this large team, they might just be sitting there. Or, I mean, your options aren't very good, right? Option number one is you get rid of everyone. That kills morale in the company. Option number two is they're sitting around not doing much. That's not good for morale, and it's costing you a bunch of money. Right. Option number three, which is what they end up usually doing, is we're going to have this team start working on the next generation product, not because you should be, but because you've got them in place. And so you're doing it suboptimally, because you're doing it without a lot of the input that you're going to get from the market. You know, you're doing it at the wrong time, and you're really doing it for the wrong reasons. And that's one of those problems. So it's very advantageous to be able to, you know, have access to a very large multifunctional team, but be able to turn them off for a period of time when you need to, and bring them back on, you know, when the time is right.
Yeah. Yep. And not saying that there's never a point where a company should bring on full-time staff. I mean, there definitely is. But if this is your first product, you got to get to market with the least amount of cost possible. I mean, it's just, that has to be your goal. And then from there, if you're successful, then okay, then you could start bringing on, you know, engineering and bringing on these different staffs and grow your company. And I've seen companies do it, you know, perfect like that. But you just see sometimes people kind of go too fast and, you know, spend their money a little too quickly. So the other thing, you know, I send a sheet around to all my guests and just try to get a skeleton of things we should talk about. And that way I don't forget, just in case I get too into the weeds with you on something. You know, one thing we talked about was three questions to ask before picking a connected medical device product development firm. Do you remember all three? If not, I can read you the question and you can tell me the answer.
You read them and I'll tell you what I meant.
Yeah. So the first one was, what types of products do you develop? And you said you'll want to hear medical devices that connect to the cloud. You want to explain that one?
You know, that's specifically if you're looking for that kind of product. Mm-hmm. The broader, the more general response to that is, and the point that I make in that is that you want to find a team that specializes in the type of product that you're trying to build, mm-hmm. right? So if you're making a new catheter, try to find a firm that specializes in developing catheters, right? If you're developing a medical device that's wireless and cloud connected, try to find a development partner that specializes in that type of product. The reason that I think that's important is that when you do something over and over, you build, first of all, you build expertise in that. So you become more efficient at it. Secondly, you become much more aware with what can go wrong, so you risk mitigate better. Third, you end up developing assets that are usable in a variety of projects. So, you know, as an example, most devices that connect to a mobile phone are going to use Bluetooth Low Energy. It's kind of the pervasive, you know, ubiquitous technology for connecting to a mobile phone. The drivers, some of that software, that firmware that you build for Bluetooth Low Energy communications, once you've done it 2 or 3 times, it's effectively the same thing, right? So if you've got an EKG device, or you've got an ultrasound device, or you've got an activity tracker, or you've got a, you know, whatever, a heart rate monitor, they're different in their application, they're different in their sensors, but the way they communicate to the phone is pretty similar. And so, you know, for us, we've already built a lot of these assets. So when a new client comes in, we're not reinventing the wheel from scratch. We're leveraging some of those building blocks that we've used in the past. You know, if you're, so my point really is, you're much better served by a company that specializes and focuses, mm-hmm. versus the alternative, which is, I see it all the time. It's like, all right, what does your product firm do? We'll do anything. You know, medical, sure, we'll do medical. Oh, you're doing defense? Yeah, we'll do defense products. Oh, we'll do avionics. You know, we'll do a toaster. Right. Oh, it's connected. Yeah. I've got a guy who worked on a Bluetooth thing in college. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you're not going to get the efficiencies of a company that's focused when you go to a generalist.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And I kind of see that in the design firm, or like, you know, in I call them design houses. But I kind of see that in a lot of them is, you know, like I know some people in Florida, and I know some people in Warsaw, Indiana that focus on orthopedics, and, you know, that makes a lot of sense to go there. But yeah, I'm glad you said that, cause I do see that a lot. And then I've also come across the design firms that say we'll do anything. And it's like, yeah, it's to me, you know, I've had good experiences with them, but at the same time, it's like, it doesn't seem like a good pitch if I was the actual company. The second one you wrote is, what typical challenges should we anticipate during the development process? And, do you want to go on that one? Not the question. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there it's also partly that you're hiring a team of people. Right. And you want to know what that interaction is going to be like. Mm-hmm. So part of what you're looking for is how honest are these people, right? Yeah. Because the wrong answer to that would be like, oh, everything's going to go smoothly. We're not going to run into hiccups, or something like extremely generic. If you're asking about a specific type of product, they should be able to tell you quite a few of the potential roadblocks that you're going to face specifically. Mm-hmm. And part of that's going to tell you, you know, is this a team that I can trust to communicate effectively with me? Is this a team I can trust to give it to me straight? You know, is this a team that's experienced in the type of products that I'm asking them to develop? Because that experience tells you where the roadblocks are, you know, where the potential challenges are going to come from. So that's what you're looking for. You're looking for how experienced is this team? How knowledgeable are they? How honest and transparent are they? You know, how forthcoming are they with bad news as well as good news?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good advice. You know, that's something that I quickly learned so I've been in business development for the last like couple years now. I was at NAMSA, which is a CRO. Now I'm at Covance, which is another CRO. So they do similar things. And one of the points I always harp on with clients is, you know, oftentimes we're competing against other people. They're either going out and getting competitive bids, and look, I could sit here and tell you that we've done this many 510Ks, we've done all of this, but the important thing is, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say, yeah, we're going to get through the 510K, no questions asked, they won't be a single comment, and we'll get approval the first time around. Does that happen? Maybe sometimes, but not all the time, right? It's how are you going to handle the adversity? And how have you set yourself up internally to handle that, right? So that's one thing I always harp on is look, we're at the FDA every week. We know the reviewers. We've done like products. We've saved what the sticky points were there. We understand where those sticky points are, and we're going to help avoid those. Are there going to be new ones? Maybe, but we, you know, and if there is, that's okay, because we have all these resources waiting in the background, kind of like you said with engineering, to pull in when you need it and help mitigate those issues. So I think that's a great point, because that's what customers need to hear, and that's what customers need, is that honesty. It's the same thing with investors. When you're going out and raising money, don't go in there and say, don't try to hide where you know your bumps are going to be. Cause if you do that, you're setting yourself up for a poor relationship right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the VCs I've had on the podcast say that happens so often, where the client knew where the pain points were and hid them, and it made for a really bumpy relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not a good look. You know, you're going into business with these people. You want them to be part of your team. Be honest with them.
Yeah. You know, on the other side of that equation, it's helpful too, meaning that, you know, if I get a client, they ask me a question like that, I'm going to list everything I can think of that's going to go wrong. If that scares them away, they probably weren't going to be a very good client.
Right.
You know, there's a certain level of maturity that's necessary when you're asking for somebody to do product development that recognizes that this stuff is complex, it's nonlinear, there are surprises. And you need to have the maturity and, you know, the steady handedness to plan for that, right? To plan for the unexpected, to expect it, to be able to get through it, et cetera.
Yeah. So, and you know, one of the other things I asked you was some other topics you were passionate about, and you had entrepreneurship down here. And you can kind of see that as you talk. But, you know, maybe talk a little bit about what it takes to be, you know, an entrepreneur. What's some of the best advice you have for, hey, I have this idea. I'm at this comfy job, you know, and I want to take a risk. You know, you've been through that. So maybe talk a little bit about what it takes to do that. You know, what's your advice for someone who's thinking about that? I'd be curious. Yeah.
Yeah. So, lots of things. It is something that I'm passionate about. You know, there's a really good book by, what's his name? Ben Horowitz, I think it is, The Hard Thing About Hard Things. And it's precisely about building startups. But one of the things that he says in that book, it's been a while, so I'll paraphrase and hopefully I won't butcher it, that he says, you know, there's two types of hard, right? There's hard, like climbing Mount Everest, where it's just hard, right?
Yep.
There's hard, like solving a complex calculus problem, right? And one of those is like, you know, you can train for it, you can prepare for it, you can do that sort of thing, you know, but it's going to be hard no matter what. The other one is hard just because you don't know. And so that one's easier to solve. That one just requires learning. And
yeah,
learning means, you know, you should be reading a lot of books because there's a lot of people who have gone through this path before you and can help, you know, help you avoid some of the common problems that first-time entrepreneurs have. Definitely, you got to find good mentors. Most successful people out there enjoy helping the next generation, if you will, figure out how to do things right. Mm-hmm. But it does take dedication from the aspiring entrepreneur to seek those people out, to pitch themselves, right? Like those people who are successful, they probably have a variety of people coming to them trying to get advice and mentorship. So you got to make yourself attractive to them. Mm-hmm. So learn how to reach out to them, you know, pick their brain. These days it's easier than ever with Zoom. Just ask for somebody for 15 minutes, 30 minutes of their time, you know, really listen, do your homework ahead of time, but find people who are going to help lend you, you know, their scar tissue, right? So this is something that one of my mentors, I heard him say one time was, you know, you learn from your mistakes and you learn from your injuries, if you will. That's fine. But where possible, it's better to borrow scar tissue from somebody else, right? So if somebody else has gone through what you're about to go through and has experienced some of that pain and has learned from it, it's a lot more efficient to learn from them than to have to go through it yourself. And the only way you do that is by talking to a lot of people and really asking questions and all of that. So that's part of it. I'd say one of the hardest things of entrepreneurship is that you need to have a pretty broad understanding of things, right? So, you know, if you're an engineer, you've actually had a very narrow focused academic path, you know, or maybe career. And in business and entrepreneurship, you actually need to be more of a generalist, more broad. So what does that mean? That means you have to kind of understand the basics of finance. You have to understand the basics of marketing and sales and, you know, hiring and managing and HR and, you know, just all of these little things that maybe you've never had to concern yourself with. Well, it's time to understand the basics, not so that you're going to do it all, because you shouldn't. You're also going to learn to delegate. But how are you going to find someone who's really good at finance if you don't know the first thing about it, right? How are you going to have intelligent conversations? And part of your role, particularly if you're in the leadership, you know, you don't have to be, right? So you can be an entrepreneur and find partners who have more of leadership experience. But if you are in that quarterback role, you kind of need to understand all those things to understand how they go together and form good strategy and, you know, and manage a good team.
Yeah, no, it's great advice. You know, I think that the most successful startups that we've worked with, they do have a CEO who is a generalist in just a lot of areas, right? Because I think it's important to be able to spot talent and utilize that talent, but understand that, you know, a regulatory person is going to see the world with regulatory glasses. A reimbursement person is going to see the world under reimbursement lenses. An engineering person says, yeah, I know engineering and I don't, you know, why do we need to worry about the FDA, right? Or anything like that. Quality engineers are going to say, well, I'll tell you why. So, you know, it's all of that, but it's understanding that, to take everything with a grain of salt, you know, because that's how other people are seeing it. So that's good advice as well. I like that. Good. I wrote down a couple wrap up things. Do you have anything else for me that I missed?
Not really. I think we covered.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Yeah. No. So I wanted to ask, I was curious. Do you happen to sit on any boards? Is that something you've done before or want to do or interested in doing? So I just recently started asking this of some guests who I wasn't sure if they actually did, but just talking to them made me think like, boy, a startup company could really use this person's advice. So I wasn't sure. Is that something you've already done or are actually interested in doing?
I haven't. I've formally sat on the board of my last company, of course. I regularly attend board meetings, or I'm regularly invited to board meetings for our clients. Mm-hmm. And that's primarily to represent the function of product development, right? So especially for clients for whom we are the product development team, you know, oftentimes they'll want their executive management team to present to the board, like where things are on various, phases, whether it's finance, product, clinical, regulatory. Yep. And so I'll get invited to present on that front. But I don't have a formal seat on a board of directors. It's not really something that I'm focused on. But I'm always happy to help by bringing in, you know, an outsider's perspective to a board meeting.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so how do companies, engage you? Is it going to the website and reaching out? And what kind of engagements, you know, do you do ad hoc engagements? Do you actually take equity in companies? Do you invest in companies? Maybe just talk a little bit about, you know, how a company might work with Boldtype.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, in terms of engaging us, you can find me on LinkedIn, right? Jose Borges. You can come to the website, boldtype.com. That contact me on the right, like literally goes directly to myself.
Okay.
We're about a 30 person team, but I do all of the business development and, and so they get direct access to me through that path. In terms of how we work with companies, usually we'll set up a first 30-minute, somewhat informal conversation just to learn about each other and get a first pass decision point of, is this a good match or not on both sides? And then from that, if it does seem like it's a good match, we'll put an NDA in place and we'll do a second, a little bit more formal meeting for about an hour where we do more of a formal pitch, right? Like a presentation, slides, here's who we are, here's what we do, here's our process. And on the client side, we'll ask, tell us more about the product. We're under NDA now, so we can learn more about it. Mm-hmm. And very soon after that, we're actually able to come up with like an architecture for the product very quickly after that, again, because we're focused. So oftentimes we'll do the next meeting is kind of a draft proposal where, you know, we'll talk about, okay, here's what we understand you're trying to build from what you've told us. Here's what the architecture for that might look like. Here's what a Gantt chart might look like for developing that. You know, it's going to have bigger error bars at this point. You know, there's more uncertainty because it's very early. And mm-hmm. So here's kind of the first phase of effort that's going to be completed. By then, we'll have a much better sense of what that timeline and budget are going to look like. And then, you know, we oftentimes like to work in a phased approach, just two phases. Like a first phase is doing a lot of the upfront work where we do deliver valuable assets at the end of that, but it also helps us really understand the problem and the solution better. At the end of that phase, we'll give a much more extensive statement of work or proposal, because by then we'll both really understand each other. We'll understand the product well, we'll understand how the working engagement goes, and we'll have a better estimate of what the product is going to cost and how long it's going to take. In terms of how we engage clients, we're primarily a time and materials firm.
Okay.
From time to time, we'll do smaller fixed price type of projects. And that's generally, if it's very well understood what the deliverable is going to be, and there's very little chance of scope creep. Mm-hmm. But primarily we focus on time and materials. And, we haven't done much in terms of equity or, you know, kind of incentive-based payment, but we're open to it. I think if the opportunity, if it makes sense, if there's good reason to do it, we're open to it. Just hasn't a lot of times from the client side and from our side, it's just cleaner to just be a straight time and material engagement.
Yeah, no, helpful. And out of curiosity, where are you located?
So we're primarily located in Orlando, Florida.
Okay.
But we do have engineers that are in other places of the country.
Okay, very good. So in terms of clientele, it doesn't matter, right? I don't have to be in Orlando, Florida. I could be in Cleveland, Ohio, for example.
Yeah, in fact, interestingly, I think we've only had maybe one client in Florida at all. Like most of them spread out. So we got people in Boston and Texas and Arizona we've got somebody in Illinois. So these days it's pretty easy. We also got pretty fortunate in like with the whole COVID thing. One of my ideas when I started the company was to build it in such a way that I could recruit the best talent no matter where they were. Okay. I didn't want to restrict my talent pool to where the office was, if you will. Right. And so we built the company from the beginning to be very virtual friendly. And so we have a lot of tools in place that allow us to operate virtually. And we have an office. We have about, I think it's 8,000 square feet. But we were already in that mode where people could work from home whenever they wanted. And some people always work remotely. So it's been very easy to transition to now. Right now we have one or two people who make it to the office regularly, but most people are working remotely and it's not an issue.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. No, helpful. Jose, that's all I have for you. Hang on the line and we'll do a little wrap up here once I stop the recording portion. Just as an FYI for all the listeners, if you want to get a hold of Jose, a link to his LinkedIn page will be in the show notes. So depending on where you're listening to us at, you can just go up or down an inch and click on his name. It'll take you to his LinkedIn page. I'll also have a URL to his the website for Bold Type. And you can connect him that way. And if you wanted a warm introduction, you can come through me. But outside of that, Jose, I really appreciate your time. It was great getting to learn a little bit about what Bold Type does and what you do and the kind of value you could bring to a company. And hopefully the listeners picked up on a few things. And we appreciate your time.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you have any questions for myself or Jose, there's a link to our LinkedIn pages in the show notes, or email the podcast and I'll make sure to get you in touch with him. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe and leave a review, and feel free to visit the webpage www.projectmedtech.com or send us an email at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks and have a great day.